Side 3. Sphere by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 95. Looking up, they saw Teeny Fletcher standing on a platform among a network of pipes near the curved top of the cylinder. "Everything's under control, gentlemen. Just a small leak in the liquid waste disposal pipe that goes to the H2O recycler."
"Liquid waste?"
Ted was shaking his head. "Just a small leak," Fletcher said. "No problem, sir." She sprayed one of the pipes with white foam from a spray canister. The foam sputtered and hardened on the pipe. "We just urethane the suckers when we get them. Makes a perfect seal."
"How often do you get these leaks?" Harry said.
"Liquid waste?" Ted said again.
"Hard to say, Dr. Adams, but don't worry, really."
"I feel sick," Ted said.
Harry slapped him on the back. "Come on, it won't kill you. Let's get some sleep."
"I think I'm going to throw up."
They went into the sleeping chamber. Ted immediately ran off to the showers. They heard him coughing and gagging. "Poor Ted," Harry said, shaking his head. Norman said, "What's all this business about a black hole, anyway?" "A black hole," Harry said, "is a dead, compressed star. Basically, a star is like a big beach ball inflated by the atomic explosions occurring inside it. When a star gets old and runs out of nuclear fuel, the ball collapses to a much smaller size. If it collapses enough, it becomes so dense and it has so much gravity that it keeps on collapsing, squeezing down on itself until it is very dense and very small, only a few miles in diameter. Then it's a black hole. Nothing else in the universe is as dense as a black hole."
"So they're black because they're dead?"
"Nope, they're black because they trap all the light. Black holes have so much gravity they pull everything into them, like vacuum cleaners. All the surrounding interstellar gas and dust, and even light itself, they just suck it right up."
"They suck up light?" Norman said. He found it hard to think of that.
"Yes." "So, what were you two so excited about with your calculations?"
"Oh, it's a long story, and it's just speculation," Harry yawned. "It probably won't amount to anything anyway. Talk about it later?"
"Sure," Norman said. Harry rolled over, went to sleep. Ted was still in the showers, hacking and sputtering. Norman went back to D-Cell to Tina's console. "Did Harry find you all right?" he said. "I know he wanted to see you."
"Yes, sir, and I have the information he requested now. Why, did you want to make out your will, too?"
Norman frowned. "Dr. Adams said he didn't have a will and he wanted to make one. He seemed to feel it was quite urgent. Anyway, I checked with the surface, and you can't do it. It's some legal problem about it being in your own handwriting. You can't transmit your will over electronic lines."
"Yeah, I see.
I'm sorry, Dr. Johnson. Should I tell the others as well?"
"No," Norman said. "Don't bother the others. We'll be going to the surface soon, right after we have one last look at the ship."
The Large Glass. This time they split up inside the spaceship. Barnes, Ted, and Edmonds continued forward in the vast cargo bays to search the parts of the ship that were still unexplored. Norman, Beth, and Harry stayed in what they now called the flight deck, looking for the flight recorder. Ted's parting words were, "It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done." Then he set off with Barnes. Edmonds left them a small video monitor so they could see the progress of the other team in the forward section of the ship. And they could hear. Ted chattered continuously to Barnes, giving his views about structural features of the ship. The design of the big cargo bays reminded Ted of the stonework of the ancient Mycenaeans in Greece, particularly the Lion Gate ramp at Mycenae. "Ted has more irrelevant facts at his fingertips than any man I know," Harry said. "Can we turn the volume down?" Yawning, Norman turned the monitor down. He was tired. The bunks in DH-8 were damp, the electric blankets heavy and clinging. Sleep had been almost impossible. And then Beth had come storming in after her talk with Barnes. She was still angry now.
"Goddamn Barnes," she said. "Where does he get off?"
"He's doing the best he can, like everyone else," Norman said. She spun.
You know, Norman, sometimes you're too psychological and understanding. The man is an idiot, a complete idiot.
Let's just find the flight recorder, shall we?
Harry said. That's the important thing now.
Harry was following the umbilicus cable that ran out the back of the mannequin into the floor. He was lifting up floor panels, tracing the wires aft.
I'm sorry, Beth said.
But he wouldn't speak like that to a man. Certainly not to Ted. Ted's hogging the whole show, and I don't see why he should be allowed to.
What does Ted have to do with... Norman began.
The man is a parasite, that's what he is. He takes the ideas of others and promotes them as his own. Even the way he quotes famous sayings, it's outrageous.
You feel he takes other people's ideas? Norman said.
Listen, back on the surface, I mentioned to Ted that we ought to have some words ready when we open this thing. And the next thing I know, Ted's making up quotes and positioning himself in front of the camera.
Well, what, Norman? Don't well me, for Christ's sake. It was my idea, and he took it without so much as a thank you.
Did you say anything to him about it? Norman said.
No, I did not say anything to him about it. I'm sure he wouldn't remember if I did. He'd go, did you say that, Beth? I suppose you might have mentioned something like that, yes.
I still think you should talk to him.
Norman, you're not listening to me.
If you talked to him, at least you wouldn't be so angry about it now.
Shrink talk,
she said, shaking her head. Look, Ted does whatever he wants on this expedition. He makes his stupid speeches, whatever he wants. But I go through the door first, and Barnes gives me hell. Why shouldn't I go first?
What's wrong with a woman being the first for once in the history of science?
Beth. And then I had the gall to turn on the lights. You know what Barnes said about that? He said I might have started a short circuit and put us all in jeopardy. He said I didn't know what I was doing. He said I was impulsive.
Jesus. Impulsive.
Stone Age military cretin.
Turn the volume back up, Harry said. I'd rather hear Ted.
Come on, guys.
We're all under a lot of pressure, Beth, Norman said. It's going to affect everybody in different ways. She glared at Norman.
You're saying Barnes was right?
I'm saying we're all under pressure, including him,
including you.
Jesus, you men always stick together.
You know why I'm still an assistant professor and not tenured?
Your pleasant, easygoing personality, Harry said.
I can do without this. I really can.
Beth, Harry said,
you see the way these cables are going? They're running toward that bulkhead there. See if they go up the wall on the other side of the door.
You trying to get rid of me?
If possible,
she laughed, breaking the tension.
All right, I'll look on the other side of the door.
When she was gone, Harry said, she's pretty worked up. Norman said, you know the Ben Stone story?
Which one?
Beth did her graduate work in Stone's lab.
Oh.
Benjamin Stone was a biochemist at BU. A colorful, engaging man. Stone had a reputation as a good researcher who used his graduate students like lab assistants, taking their results as his own. In this exploitation of others' work, Stone was not unique in the academic community, but he proceeded a little more ruthlessly than his colleagues. Beth was living with him as well.
Uh-huh.
Back in the early 70s. Apparently she did a series of important experiments on the energetics of ciliary inclusion bodies. They had a big argument, and Stone broke off his relationship with her. She left the lab, and he published 5 papers, all her work, without her name on them.
Very nice, Harry said.
So now she lifts weights?
Well, she feels mistreated, and I can see your point.
Yeah, Harry said.
But the thing is, lie down with dogs, get up with fleas, you know what I mean?
Jesus, Beth said, returning. This is like the girl who's raped is always asking for it. Is that what you're saying?
No, Harry said, still lifting up floor panels, following the wires. But sometimes you gotta ask what the girl is doing in a dark alley at 3 a.m. in a bad part of town. I was in love with him. It's still a bad part of town. I was 22 years old.
How old do you have to be?
Up yours, Harry.
Harry shook his head. You find the wires, Butch?
Yes, I found the wires. They go into some kind of a glass grid.
Let's have a look,
Norman said, going next door. He'd seen flight recorders before. They were long, rectangular metal boxes, reminiscent of safe deposit boxes, painted red or bright orange. If this was... He stopped. He was looking at a transparent glass cube, 1 foot on each side. Inside the cube was an intricate grid arrangement of fine, glowing blue lines. Between the glowing lines, blue lights flickered intermittently. There were two pressure gauges mounted on top of the cube, and three pistons, and there were a series of silver stripes and rectangles on the outer surface on the left side. It didn't look like anything he had seen before. Interesting. Harry peered into the cube. Some kind of optronic memory is my guess. We don't have anything like it. He touched the silver stripes on the outside. Not paint, it's some plastic material. Probably machine readable. By what? Certainly not us. No, probably a robot recovery device of some kind. And the pressure gauges? The cube is filled with some kind of gas under pressure. Maybe it contains biological components to attain that compactness. In any case, I'll bet this large glass is a memory device. A flight recorder? Their equivalent, yes. How do we access it? Watch this, Beth said, going back to the flight deck. She began pushing sections of the console, activating it. Don't tell Barnes, she said over her shoulder. How do you know where to press? I don't think it matters, he said. I think the console can sense where you are. The control panel keeps track of the pilot? Something like that. In front of them, a section of the console glowed, making a screen, yellow on black. RV-LHOOQ. DCOM-1. USS Star Voyager. Then nothing. Harry said, now we get the bad news. What bad news? Norman said. And he wondered, why had Harry stayed behind to look for the flight recorder instead of going with Ted and Barnes to explore the rest of the ship? Why was he so interested in the past history of this vessel? Maybe it won't be bad, Harry said. Why do you think it might be? Because, Harry said, if you consider it logically, something vitally important is missing from this ship. At that moment, the screen filled with columns. Ship systems, life systems, data systems, quartermaster, flight records, core operations, deck control, integration, direct, LSS test 1.0, LSS test 2.0, LSS test 3.0, propulsion systems, waste manage, V9, status OM2, outer, status OM3, inner, status OM4, fore, status DV7, aft, status V, summa, status COMREC 2, line A9-11, line A12-BX, Stabilix. What's your pleasure? Beth said, hands on the console. Flight records, Harry said. He bit his lip. Flight data summaries, RV-LHOOQ, FDS 1143, 123145, FDS 1146, 123148. FDS 1149, 123151, FDS 1152, 123153, FDS 1154, 123154, FDS 1155, 63155, FDS 7155, 123155, FDS 1156, 13156, FDS 2156, entry event, FDS entry event. FDS entry event summary. 8:06. !! OZ/010/ odd-000/XXX/X. F$SXX/XXX-UP-X/XXX-X@(X!).
What do you make of that? Norman said. Harry was peering at the screen. As you see, the earliest records are in 3-year intervals. Then they're shorter, 1 year. Then 6 months, and finally 1 month.
than this entry-event business.
So they were recording more and more carefully, Beth said, as the ship approached the entry-event, whatever it was.
I have a pretty good idea what it was, Harry said. I just can't believe that... Let's start. How about entry-event summary?
Beth pushed buttons.
On the screen, a field of stars, and around the edges of the field, a lot of numbers. It was three-dimensional, giving the illusion of depth.
Holographic?
Not exactly, but similar.
Several large magnitude stars there.
Or planets.
What planets?
I don't know. This is one for Ted, Harry said. He may be able to identify the image. Let's go on.
He touched the console. The screen changed.
More stars.
Yeah, and more numbers. The numbers around the edges of the screen were flickering, changing rapidly. The stars don't seem to be moving, but the numbers are changing.
No, look, the stars are moving too.
They could see that all the stars were moving away from the center of the screen, which was now black and empty.
No stars in the center, and everything moving away, Harry said thoughtfully.
The stars on the outside were moving very quickly, streaking outward. The black center was expanding.
Why is it empty like that in the center, Harry? Beth said.
I don't think it is empty.
I can't see anything.
No, but it's not empty. In just a minute we should see...
There! A dense white cluster of stars suddenly appeared in the center of the screen. The cluster expanded as they watched.
It was a strange effect, Norman thought. There was still a distinct black ring that expanded outward, with stars on the outside and on the inside. It felt as if they were flying through a giant black donut.
My God, Harry said softly. Do you know what you are looking at?
No,
Beth said.
What's that cluster of stars in the center?
It's another universe.
It's what?
Well, okay, it's probably another universe. Or it might be a different region of our own universe. Nobody really knows for sure.
What's the black donut? Norman said.
It's not a donut. It's a black hole.
What you are seeing is the recording made as this spacecraft went through a black hole and entered into another...
Is someone calling?
Harry turned, cocked his head. They fell silent but heard nothing.
What do you mean, another universe?
Shh!
A short silence. And then a faint voice crying,
Hello!
Who's that? Norman said, straining to listen. The voice was so soft, but it sounded human. And maybe more than one voice. It was coming from somewhere inside the spacecraft.
Yoo-hoo! Anybody there? Hello!
Oh, for God's sake, Beth said. It's them on the monitor. She turned up the volume on the little monitor Edmonds had left behind. On the screen they saw Ted and Barnes standing in a room somewhere and shouting, Hello!
Hello!
Can we talk back?
Yes, press that button on the side.
Norman said, We hear you.
High damn time, Ted.
All right now, Barnes said. Listen up.
What are you people doing back there? Ted said.
Listen up, Barnes said. He stepped to one side, revealing a piece of multicolored equipment. We now know what this ship is for.
So do we, Harry said.
We do,
Beth and Norman said together. But Barnes wasn't listening. And the ship seems to have picked up something on its travels.
Picked up something? What is it?
I don't know, Barnes said. But it's something alien.
Something alien.
The moving walkway carried them past endless, large cargo bays. They were going forward to join Barnes and Ted and Edmonds and to see their alien discovery.
Why would anyone send a spaceship through a black hole? Beth asked.
Because of gravity, Harry said. You see, black holes have so much gravity they distort space and time incredibly. You remember how Ted was saying that planets and stars make dents in the fabric of space-time? Well, black holes make tears in the fabric.
And some people think it's possible to fly through those tears into another universe, or another part of our universe, or to another time.
Another time?
That's the idea, Harry said. Are you people coming? Barnes's tinny voice on the monitor. In transit now, Beth said, glowering at the screen.
He can't see you, Norman said.
I don't care.
They rode past more cargo areas. Harry said, I can't wait to see Ted's face when we tell him. Finally, they reached the end of the walkway. They passed through a midsection of struts and girders and entered a large forward room which they had previously seen on the monitor. With ceilings nearly 100 feet high, it was enormous. You could put a 6-story building in this room, Norman thought. Looking up, he saw a hazy mist or fog. What's that? That's a cloud, Barnes said, shaking his head. The room is so big it apparently has its own weather. Maybe it even rains in here sometimes. The room was filled with machinery on an immense scale. At first glance, it looked like oversized earth-moving machinery, except it was brightly painted in primary colors, glistening with oil. Then Norman began to notice individual features. There were giant claw hands, enormously powerful arms, moving gear wheels, and an array of buckets and receptacles. He realized suddenly he was looking at something very similar to the grippers and claws mounted on the front end of the Charon V submersible he had ridden down on the day before. Was it the day before? Or was it still the same day? Which day? Was this July 4th? How long had they been down here? If you look carefully, Barnes was saying, you can see that some of these devices appear to be large-scale weapons. Others, like that long extensor arm, the various attachments to pick things up, in effect make this ship a gigantic robot.
A robot? No kidding, Beth said.
I guess it would have been appropriate for a robot to open it after all, Ted said thoughtfully.
Maybe even fitting.
Snug fitting, Beth said. Pipe fitting, Norman said.
Sort of robot to robot, you mean?
Harry said.
Sort of a meeting of the threads and treads. Hey, Ted said. I don't make fun of your comments, even when they're stupid.
I wasn't aware they ever were, Harry said.
You say foolish things sometimes, thoughtless.
Children, Barnes said, can we get back to the business at hand? Point it out the next time, Ted.
I will.
I'll be glad to know when I say something foolish.
No problem.
Something you consider foolish. Tell you what, Barnes said to Norman, when we go back to the surface, let's leave these two down here.
Surely you can't think of going back now, Ted said.
We've already voted.
But that was before we found the object.
Where is the object? Harry said.
Over here, Harry,
Ted said with a wicked grin. Let's see what your fabled powers of deduction make of this. They walked deeper into the room, moving among the giant hands and claws. And they saw, nestled in the padded claw of one hand, a large, perfectly polished silver sphere, about 30 feet in diameter. The sphere had no markings or features of any kind. They moved around the sphere, seeing themselves reflected in the polished metal. Norman noticed an odd, shifting iridescence, faint rainbow hues of blue and red gleaming in the metal.
It looks like an oversized ball bearing, Harry said.
Keep walking, smart guy.
On the far side, they discovered a series of deep, convoluted grooves cut in an intricate pattern into the surface of the sphere. The pattern was arresting, though Norman could not immediately say why. The pattern wasn't geometric, and it wasn't amorphous or organic either. It was hard to say what it was. Norman had never seen anything like it. And as he continued to look at it, he felt increasingly certain this was a pattern never found on Earth, never created by any man, never conceived by a human imagination. Ted and Barnes were right, he felt sure of it. This sphere was something alien.
Priorities.
Huh, Harry said, after staring in silence for a long time. I'm sure you'll want to get back to us on this, Ted said. About where it came from and so on. Actually, I know where it came from. And he told Ted about the star record and the black hole.
Actually, Ted said, I suspected that this ship was made to travel through a black hole for some time.
Did you? What was your first clue?
The heavy radiation shielding.
Harry nodded.
That's true.
You probably guessed the significance of that before I did. He smiled.
But you didn't tell anybody.
Hey, Ted said. There's no question about it. I was the one who proposed the black hole first.
You did?
Yes, no question at all. Remember in the conference room? I was explaining to Norman about space-time, and I started to do the calculations for the black hole, and then you joined in. Norman, you remember that. I proposed it first.
Norman said, that's true. You had the idea.
Harry grinned. I didn't feel that was a proposal. I thought it was more like a guess.
Or a speculation.
Harry, Ted said, you are rewriting history. There are witnesses.
Since you're so far ahead of everybody else, Harry said, how about telling us your proposals for the nature of this object?
With pleasure, Ted said.
This object is a burnished sphere of approximately 10 meters in diameter, not solid, and composed of a dense metal alloy of an as-yet-unknown nature. The cabalistic markings on this side, these grooves are what you're calling cabalistic.
Do you mind if I finish?
The cabalistic markings on this side clearly suggest artistic or religious ornamentation, evoking a ceremonial quality. This indicates the object has significance to whoever made it.
I think we can be sure that's true.
Personally, I believe that this sphere is intended as a form of contact with us, visitors from another star, another solar system. It is, if you will, a greeting, a message, or a trophy, a proof that a higher form of life exists in the universe.
All well and good and beside the point, Harry said. What does it do?
I'm not sure it does anything. I think it just is. It is what it is.
Very zen.
Well, what's your idea?
Let's review what we know, Harry said, as opposed to what we imagine in a flight of fancy. This is a spacecraft from the future, built with all sorts of materials and technology we haven't developed yet, although we are about to develop them. This ship was sent by our descendants through a black hole and into another universe, or another part of our universe.
Yes.
This spacecraft is unmanned, but equipped with robot arms which are clearly designed to pick up things that it finds. So we can think of this ship as a huge version of the unmanned Mariner spacecraft that we sent in the 1970s to Mars to look for life there. This spacecraft from the future is much bigger and more complicated, but it's essentially the same sort of machine. It's a probe.
Yes.
So the probe goes into another universe where it comes upon this sphere. Presumably it finds the sphere floating in space, or perhaps the sphere is sent out to meet the spacecraft.
Right, Ted said. Sent out to meet it, as an emissary. That's what I think.
In any case, our robot spacecraft, according to whatever built-in criteria it has, decides that this sphere is interesting. It automatically grabs the sphere in its big claw hand here, draws it inside the ship, and brings it home.
Except in going home it goes too far. It goes into the past.
It's past, Harry said. Our present.
Right.
Barnes snorted impatiently. Fine, so this spacecraft goes out and picks up a silver alien sphere and brings it back. Get to the point. What is this sphere?
Harry walked forward to the sphere, pressed his ear against the metal, and rapped it with his knuckles.
He touched the grooves, his hands disappearing in the deep indentations.
The sphere was so highly polished, Norman could see Harry's face distorted in the curve of the metal.
Yes, as I suspected, these cabalistic markings, as you call them, are not decorative at all. They have another purpose entirely, to conceal a small break in the surface of the sphere. Thus they represent a door.
Harry stepped back. What is the sphere?
I'll tell you what I think, Harry said. I think this sphere is a hollow container. I think there's something inside, and I think it scares the hell out of me.
First evaluation. No, Mr. Secretary, Barnes said into the phone. We're pretty sure it is an alien artifact. There doesn't seem to be any question about that. He glanced at Norman sitting across the room. Yes, sir, Barnes said. Very damn exciting. They were back in the habitat, and Barnes had immediately called Washington. He was trying to delay their return to the surface. Not yet. We haven't opened it. Well, we haven't been able to open it. The door is a weird shape, and it's very finely milled. No, you couldn't wedge anything in the crack. He looked at Norman, rolled his eyes. No, we tried that, too. There don't seem to be any exterior controls. No, no message on the outside. No, no labels either. All it is a highly polished sphere with some convoluted grooves on one side. What? Blast it open? Norman turned away. He was in D's cylinder in the communications section run by Tina Chan. She was adjusting a dozen monitors with her usual calm. Norman said, You seem like the most relaxed person here. She smiled. Just inscrutable, sir. Is that it? It must be, sir, she said, adjusting the vertical gain on one rolling monitor. The screen showed the polished sphere. Because I feel my heart pounding, sir. What do you think is inside that thing? I haven't any idea, Norman said. Do you think there's an alien inside? You know, some kind of a living creature? Maybe. And we're trying to open it up? Maybe we shouldn't let it out, whatever is in there. Aren't you curious? Norman said. Not that curious, sir.
I don't see how blasting would work. Barnes was saying on the phone. Yes, we have SMTMPs, yes. Oh, different sizes. But I don't think we can blast the sucker open. No. Well, if you saw it, you'd understand. The thing is perfectly made. Perfect.
Tina adjusted a second monitor. They had two views of the sphere, and soon there would be a third. Edmonds was setting up cameras to watch the sphere. That had been one of Harry's suggestions. Harry had said, Monitor it. Maybe it does something from time to time. Have some activity. On the screen, he saw the network of wires that had been attached to the sphere. They had a full array of passive sensors. Sound and the full electromagnetic spectrum from infrared to gamma and X-rays. The readouts on the sensors were displayed on a bank of instruments to the left. Harry came in. Getting anything yet? Tina shook her head. So far, nothing. Has Ted come back? No, Norman said. Ted's still there. Ted had remained behind in the cargo bay, ostensibly to help Edmonds set up the cameras. But in fact, they knew he would try to open the sphere. They saw Ted now on the second monitor, probing the grooves, touching, pushing. Harry smiled. He hasn't got a prayer, Norman said. Harry, remember when we were in the flight deck and you said you wanted to make out your will because something was missing? Oh, that, Harry said. Forget it. That's irrelevant now. Barnes was saying, No, Mr. Secretary, raising it to the surface would be just about impossible. Well, sir, it is presently located inside a cargo bay half a mile inside the ship, and the ship is buried under 30 feet of coral. And the sphere itself is a good 30 feet across. It's the size of a small house.
I just wonder what's in the house, Tina said.
On the monitor, Ted kicked the sphere in frustration. Not a prayer, Harry said again. He'll never get it open. Beth came in. How are we going to open it?
Harry said, How?
Harry stared thoughtfully at the sphere, gleaming on the monitor. There was a long silence.
Maybe we can't.
We can't open it? You mean not ever?
That's one possibility.
Norman laughed. Ted would kill himself. Barnes was saying, Well, Mr. Secretary, if you wanted to commit the necessary Navy resources to do a full-scale salvage from 1,000 feet, we might be able to undertake it starting 6 months from now when we were assured of a month of good surface weather in this region. Yes. It's winter in the South Pacific now.
Yes. Beth said, I can see it now. At great expense,
The Navy brings a mysterious alien sphere to the surface. It is transported to a top-secret government installation in Omaha. Experts from every branch come and try to open it.
Nobody can.
Like Excalibur, Norman said. Beth said, as time goes by, they try stronger and stronger methods. Eventually, they try to blow it open with a small nuclear device, and still nothing. Finally, nobody has any more ideas. The sphere sits there. Decades go by. The sphere is never opened. She shook her head. One great frustration for mankind. Norman said to Harry, do you really think that had happened, that we'd never get it open? Harry said, never is a long time. No, sir, Barnes was saying. Given this new development, we'll stay down to the last minute. Weather topside is holding at least 6 more hours, yes, sir, from the MetSat reports. Well, I have to rely on that judgment. Yes, sir. Hourly, yes, sir. He hung up, turned to the group. Okay, we have authorization to stay down 6 to 12 hours more, as long as the weather holds. Let's try to open that sphere in the time remaining. Ted's working on it now, Harry said. On the video monitor, they saw Ted Fielding slap the polished sphere with his hand and shout, open! Open, Sesame! Open up, you son of a bitch! The sphere did not respond. The anthropomorphic problem. Seriously, Norman said, I think somebody has to ask the question, should we consider not opening it up? Why? Barnes said. Listen, I just got off the phone. I know, Norman said, but maybe we should think twice about this. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Tina nodding vigorously. Harry looked skeptical. Beth rubbed her eyes, sleepy. Are you afraid, or do you have a substantive argument? Barnes said. I have the feeling, Harry said, that Norman's about to quote from his own work. Well, yes, Norman admitted, and I did put this in my report. In his report, he had called it the anthropomorphic problem. Basically, the problem was that everybody who had ever thought or written about extraterrestrial life imagined that life as essentially human. Even if the extraterrestrial life didn't look human, if it was a reptile or a big insect or an intelligent crystal, it still acted in a human way. You're talking about the movies, Barnes said. I'm talking about research papers, too. Every conception of extraterrestrial life, whether by a movie maker or a university professor, has been basically human, assuming human values, human understanding, human ways of approaching a humanly understandable universe, and generally a human appearance, two eyes, a nose, a mouth, and so on. So, Norman said, that's obviously nonsense. For one thing, there's enough variation in human behavior to make understanding just within our own species very troublesome. The differences between, say, Americans and Japanese are very great. Americans and Japanese don't really look at the world the same way at all. Yes, yes, Barnes said impatiently. We all know the Japanese are different. And when you come to a new life form, the differences may be literally incomprehensible. The values and ethics of this new form of life may be utterly different. You mean it may not believe in the sanctity of life, or thou shalt not kill, Barnes said, still impatient. No, Norman said. I mean that this creature may not be able to be killed, and so it may have no concept of killing in the first place. Barnes stopped. This creature may not be able to be killed? Norman nodded. As someone once said, you can't break the arms of a creature that has no arms. It can't be killed. You mean it's immortal? I don't know, Norman said. That's the point. I mean, Jesus, a thing that couldn't be killed, Barnes said. How would we kill it? He bit his lip. I wouldn't like to open that sphere and release a thing that couldn't be killed. Harry laughed. No promotions for that one, Hal. Barnes looked at the monitors, showing several views of the polished sphere. Finally, he said, Now, that's ridiculous. No living thing is immortal. Am I right, Beth? Actually, no, Beth said. You could argue that certain living creatures on our own planet are immortal. For example, single-celled organisms like bacteria and yeasts are apparently capable of living indefinitely. Yeasts,
Barnes snorted. We're not talking about yeasts. And to all intents and purposes, a virus could be considered immortal.
A virus?
Barnes sat down in a chair. He hadn't considered a virus. But how likely is it, really,
Harry?
I think, Harry said, that the possibilities go far beyond what we've mentioned so far. We've only considered three-dimensional creatures of the kind that exist in our three-dimensional universe, or to be more precise, the universe that we perceive as having three dimensions. Some people think our universe has 9 or 11 dimensions. Barnes looked tired. Except the other 6 dimensions are very small, so we don't notice them. Barnes rubbed his eyes. Therefore, this creature, Harry continued, may be multidimensional so that it literally does not exist, at least not entirely, in our usual three dimensions. To take the simplest case, if it were a four-dimensional creature, we would only see part of it at any time because most of the creature would exist in the fourth dimension. That would obviously make it difficult to kill. And if it were a five-dimensional creature... Just a minute. Why haven't any of you mentioned this before?
We thought you knew, Harry said.
Knew about five-dimensional creatures that can't be killed? Nobody said a word to me. He shook his head. Opening this sphere could be incredibly dangerous.
It could, yes.
What we have here is... We have Pandora's box.
That's right.
Well, Barnes said, let's consider worst cases. What's the worst case for what we might find?
Beth said, I think that's clear. Irrespective of whether it's a multidimensional creature or a virus or whatever, irrespective of whether it shares our morals or has no morals at all, the worst case is that it hits us below the belt.
Meaning?
Meaning that it behaves in a way that interferes with our basic life mechanisms. A good example is the AIDS virus. The reason why AIDS is so dangerous is not that it's new. We get new viruses every year, every week. And all viruses work in the same way. They attack cells and convert the machinery of the cells to make more viruses. What makes the AIDS virus dangerous is it attacks the specific cells that we use to defend against viruses. AIDS interferes with our basic defense mechanism, and we have no defense against it.
Well, Barnes said, if this sphere contains a creature that interferes with our basic mechanisms, what would that creature be like?
It could breathe in air and exhale cyanide gas, Beth said.
It could excrete radioactive waste, Harry said.
It could disrupt our brain waves, Norman said, interfere with our ability to think.
Or, Beth said, it might merely disrupt cardiac conduction, stop our hearts from beating.
It might produce a sound vibration that would resonate in our skeletal system and shatter our bones, Harry said. He smiled at the others. I rather like that one.
Clever, Beth said. But as usual, we're only thinking of ourselves. The creature might do nothing directly harmful to us at all.
Ah, Barnes said. It might simply exhale a toxin that kills chloroplasts so that plants could no longer convert sunlight. Then all the plants on Earth would die, and consequently all life on Earth would die.
Ah, Barnes said.
You see, Norman said, at first, I thought the anthropomorphic problem, the fact that we can only conceive of extraterrestrial life as basically human, I thought it was a failure of imagination. Man is man. All he knows is man. And all he can think of is what he knows. Yet, as you can see, that's not true. We can think of plenty of other things, but we don't. So there must be another reason why we only conceive of extraterrestrials as humans. And I think the answer is that we are, in reality, terribly frail animals, and we don't like to be reminded of how frail we are, how delicate the balances are inside our own bodies, how short our stay on Earth, and how easily it is ended. So we imagine other life forms as being like us, so we don't have to think of the real threat, the terrifying threat they may represent, without ever intending to.
There was a silence.
Of course, we mustn't forget another possibility, Barnes said. It may be that the sphere contains some extraordinary benefit to us, some wondrous new knowledge, some astonishing new idea or new technology which will improve the condition of mankind beyond our wildest dreams. Although the chances are, Harry said,
that there won't be any new idea that is useful to us.
Why?
Barnes said. Well, let's say that the aliens are 1,000 years ahead of us, just as we are relative to, say, medieval Europe. Suppose you went back to medieval Europe with a television set. There wouldn't be any place to plug it in. Barnes stared from one to another for a long time. I'm sorry, he said. This is too great a responsibility for me. I can't make the decision to open it up. I have to call Washington on this.
Ted won't be happy, Harry said.
The hell with Ted, Barnes said. I'm going to give this to the president. Until we hear from him, I don't want anybody trying to open that sphere. Barnes called for a 2-hour rest period, and Harry went to his quarters to sleep. Beth announced that she was going off to sleep, too, but she remained at the monitor station with Tina Chan and Norman. Chan's station had comfortable chairs with high backs, and Beth swiveled in the chair, swinging her legs back and forth. She played with her hair, making little ringlets by her ear, and she stared into space. Tired, Norman thought. We're all tired. He watched Tina, who moved smoothly and continuously, adjusting the monitors, checking the sensor inputs, changing the videotapes on the bank of VCRs, tense, alert. Because Edmonds was in the spaceship with Ted, Tina had to look after the recording units as well as her own communications console. The Navy woman didn't seem to be as tired as they were, but then she hadn't been inside the spaceship. To her, that spaceship was something she saw on the monitors, a TV show, an abstraction. Tina hadn't been confronted face to face with the reality of the new environment, the exhausting mental struggle to understand what was going on, what it all meant.
You look tired, sir, Tina said.
Yes, we're all tired. It's the atmosphere, she said, breathing the heliox. So much for psychological explanations, Norman thought. Tina said, the density of the air down here has a real effect. We're at 30 atmospheres. If we were breathing regular air at this pressure, it would be almost as thick as a liquid. Heliox is lighter, but it's far denser than what we're used to. You don't realize it, but it's tiring just to breathe, to move your lungs.
But you aren't tired.
Oh, I'm used to it. I've been in saturated environments before.
Is that right?
Where?
I really can't say, Dr. Johnson.
Navy operation?
She smiled. I'm not supposed to talk about it.
Is that your inscrutable smile?
I hope so, sir, but don't you think you ought to try and sleep?
He nodded. Probably. Norman considered going to sleep, but the prospect of his damp bunk was unappealing. Instead, he went down to the galley, hoping to find one of Rose Levy's desserts. Levy was not there, but there was some coconut cake under a plastic dome. He found a plate, cut a slice, and took it over to one of the portholes. But it was black outside the porthole. The grid lights were turned off, the divers gone. He saw lights in the portholes of DH-7, the diver's habitat, located a few dozen yards away. The divers must be getting ready to go back to the surface. Or perhaps they had already gone. In the porthole, he saw his own face reflected. The face looked tired and old. This is no place for a 53-year-old man, he said, watching his reflection. As he looked out, he saw some moving lights in the distance, then a flash of yellow. One of the minisubs pulled up under a cylinder at DH-7. Moments later, a second sub arrived to dock alongside it. The lights on the first sub went out. After a short time, the second sub pulled away into the black water. The first sub was left behind. What's going on? He wondered. But he was aware he didn't really care. He was too tired. He was more interested in what the cake would taste like. And looked down. The cake was eaten. Only a few crumbs remained.
Tired, he thought.
Very tired. He put his feet up on the coffee table and put his head back against the cool padding of the wall. He must have fallen asleep for a while because he awoke disoriented in darkness. He sat up, and immediately the lights came on. He saw he was still in the galley. Barnes had warned him about that, the way the habitat adjusted to the presence of people. Apparently the motion sensors stopped registering you if you fell asleep and automatically shut off the room lights. Then when you awoke and moved, the lights came back. He wondered if the lights would stay on if you snored. Who had designed all this, he wondered. Had the engineers and designers working on the Navy habitat taken snoring into account? Was there a snore sensor? More cake. He got up and walked across to the galley kitchen. Several pieces of cake were now missing. Had he eaten them? He wasn't sure. Couldn't remember. A lot of videotapes, Beth said. Norman turned around.
Yes,
Tina said. We are recording everything that goes on in this habitat as well as the other ship. It'll be a lot of material. There was a monitor mounted just above his head. It showed Beth and Tina upstairs at the communications console. They were eating cake. Aha, he thought, so that was where the cake had gone. Every 12 hours the tapes are transferred to the submarine, Tina said.
What for? Beth said.
That's so if anything happens down here, the submarine will automatically go to the surface.
Oh, great, Beth said. I won't think about that too much.
Where is Dr. Fielding now?
Tina said.
He gave up on the sphere and went into the main flight deck with Edmonds.
Norman watched the monitor. Tina had stepped out of view. Beth sat with her back to the monitor, eating the cake. On the monitor behind Beth, he could clearly see the gleaming sphere.
Monitors showing monitors, he thought. The Navy people who eventually review this stuff are going to go crazy.
Tina said, Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?
Beth chewed her cake.
Maybe, she said. I don't know.
And to Norman's horror, he saw on the monitor, behind Beth, that the door of the sphere was sliding silently open, revealing blackness inside.
Open. They must have thought he was crazy, running through the locked D cylinder and stumbling up the narrow stairs to the upper level, shouting, It's open! It's open! He came to the communications console just as Beth was wiping the last crumbs of coconut from her lips. She set down her fork.
What's open?
The sphere! Beth spun in her chair. Tina ran over from the bank of VCRs. They both looked at the monitor behind Beth. There was an awkward silence.
Looks closed to me, Norman.
It was open. I saw it.
He told them about watching in the galley on the monitor.
It was just a few seconds ago, and the sphere definitely opened.
It must have closed again while I was on my way here.
Are you sure?
That's a pretty small monitor in the galley.
I saw it, Norman said.
Replay it if you don't believe me.
Good idea, Tina said,
and she went to the recorders to play the tape back. Norman was breathing heavily, trying to catch his breath. This was the first time he had exerted himself in the dense atmosphere, and he felt the effect strongly. DH-8 was not a good place to get excited, he decided. Beth was watching him.
You okay, Norman?
I'm fine. I tell you, I saw it. It opened. Tina?
It'll take me a second here.
Harry walked in, yawning.
Beds in this place are great, aren't they?
He said.
Like sleeping in a bag of wet rice, sort of combination bed and cold shower.
He sighed.
It'll break my heart to leave.
Beth said, Norman thinks the sphere opened.
When?
He said, yawning again.
Just a few seconds ago.
Harry nodded thoughtfully.
Interesting, interesting. I see it's closed now.
We're rewinding the videotapes to look again.
Uh-huh. Is there any more of that cake?
Harry seems very cool, Norman thought. This is a major piece of news, and he doesn't seem excited at all. Why was that? Didn't Harry believe it either? Was he still sleepy, not fully awake? Or was there something else?
Here we go, Tina said.
The monitor showed jagged lines and then resolved. On the screen, Tina was saying, Hours the tapes are transferred to the submarine.
Beth, what for?
Tina,
that's so if anything happens down here, the submarine will automatically go to the surface.
Beth, oh great, I won't think about that too much.
Where is Dr. Fielding now?
Tina,
he gave up on the sphere and went into the main flight deck with Edmonds. On the screen, Tina stepped out of view. Beth remained alone in the chair, eating the cake, her back to the monitor. On screen, Tina was saying,
Do you think they'll ever get the sear open?
Beth ate her cake.
Maybe, she said. I don't know.
There was a short pause, and then on the monitor behind Beth, the door of the sphere slid open.
Hey, it did open. Keep the tape running.
On screen, Beth didn't notice the monitor. Tina, still somewhere off screen, said,
It scares me.
Beth, I don't think there's a reason to be scared. Tina,
it's the unknown.
Sure, Beth said, but an unknown thing is not likely to be dangerous or frightening. It's most likely to be just inexplicable.
I don't know how you can say that.
You afraid of snakes? Beth said on screen. All during this conversation, the sphere remained open.
Watching, Harry said, Too bad we can't see inside it.
I may be able to help that, Tina said. I'll do some image intensification work with the computer.
It almost looks like there are little lights, Harry said. Little moving lights inside the sphere.
On screen, Tina came back into view.
Snakes don't bother me.
Well, I can't stand snakes, Beth said. Slimy, cold, disgusting things.
Ah, Beth, Harry said, watching the monitor. Got snake envy?
On screen, Beth was saying, If I were a Martian who came to Earth and I stumbled upon a snake, a funny, cold, wiggling, tube-like life, I wouldn't know what to think of it. But the chance that I would stumble on a poisonous snake is very small. Less than 1% of snakes are poisonous. So as a Martian, I wouldn't be in danger from my discovery of snakes. I'd just be perplexed. That's what's likely to happen with us. We'll be perplexed. On screen, Beth was saying, Anyway, I don't think we'll ever get the sphere open. No.
Tina, I hope not.
Behind her, on the monitor, the sphere closed.
Huh,
Harry said.
How long was it open altogether?
33.4 seconds,
Tina said.
They stopped the tape. Tina said, Anybody want to see it again?
She looked pale.
Not right now, Harry said. He drummed his fingers on the arm of his chair, stared off, thinking.
No one else said anything. They just waited patiently for Harry.
Norman realized how much Group deferred to him. Harry is the person who figures things out for us, Norman thought. We need him. Rely on him.
Okay, Harry said at last.
No conclusions are possible. We have insufficient data. The question is whether the sphere was responding to something in its immediate environment or whether it just opened for reasons of its own. Where's Ted?
Ted left the sphere and went to the flight deck.
Ted's back, Ted said, grinning broadly, and I have some real news.
So do we, Beth said.
It can wait, Ted said. But I know where this ship went, Ted said excitedly. I've been analyzing the flight data summaries on the flight deck, looking at the starfields, and I know where the black hole is located.
Ted, Beth said, the sphere opened.
It did? When?
A few minutes ago. Then it closed again.
What did the monitors show?
No biological hazard. It seems to be safe. Ted looked at the screen. Then what the hell are we doing here?
Barnes came in. 2-hour rest period is over. Everybody ready to go back to the ship for a last look?
That's putting it mildly, Harry said.
The sphere was polished, silent, closed. They stood around it and stared at themselves, distorted in reflection. Nobody spoke. They just walked around it. Finally, Ted said,
I feel like this is an IQ test and I'm flunking.
You mean like the Davies message? Harry said.
Oh, that, Ted said.
Norman knew about the Davies message. It was one of the episodes that the SETI promoters wished to forget. In 1979, there had been a large meeting in Rome of the scientists involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Basically, SETI called for a radio astronomy search of the heavens. Now the scientists were trying to decide what sort of message to search for. Emerson Davies, a physicist from Cambridge, England, devised a message based on fixed physical constants, such as the wavelength of emitted hydrogen, which were presumably the same throughout the universe. He arranged these constants in a binary pictorial form. Because Davies thought this would be exactly the kind of message an alien intelligence might send, he figured it would be easy for the SETI people to figure out. He distributed his picture to everybody at the conference. Nobody could figure it out.
When Davies explained it, they all agreed it was a clever idea and a perfect message for extraterrestrials to send. But the fact remained that none of them had been able to figure out this perfect message. One of the people who had tried to figure it out and had failed was Ted.
"Well, we didn't try very hard," Ted said. "There was a lot going on at the conference. And we didn't have you there, Harry."
"You just wanted a free trip to Rome," Harry said. Beth said, "Is it my imagination, or have the door markings changed?" Norman looked. At first glance, the deep grooves appeared the same, but perhaps the pattern was different. If so, the change was subtle.
"We can compare it with old videotapes," Barnes said.
"It looks the same to me," Ted said. "Anyway, it's metal. I doubt it could change."
"What we call metal is just a liquid that flows slowly at room temperature," Harry said. "It's possible that this metal is changing."
"I doubt it," Ted said.
Barnes said, "You guys are supposed to be the experts. We know this thing can open. It's been open already. How do we get it open again?"
"We're trying, Hal."
"It doesn't look like you're doing anything." From time to time, they glanced at Harry. But Harry just stood there looking at the sphere, his hand on his chin, tapping his lower lip thoughtfully with his finger.
"Harry?"
Harry said nothing. Ted went up and slapped the sphere with the flat of his hand. It made a dull sound, but nothing happened. Ted pounded the sphere with his fist, then he winced and rubbed his hand.
"I don't think we can force our way in. I think it has to let you in," Norman said.
Nobody said anything after that.
"My hand-picked crack team," Barnes said, needling them, "and all they can do is stand around and stare at it."
"What do you want us to do, Hal? Nuke it?"
"If you don't get it open, there are people who will try that eventually."
He glanced at his watch. "Meanwhile, you got any other bright ideas?"
Nobody did.
"Okay," Barnes said. "Our time is up. Let's go back to the habitat and get ready to be ferried to the surface."
Departure.
Norman pulled the small Navy-issue bag from beneath his bunk in C-cylinder. He got his shaving kit from the bathroom, found his notebook and his extra pair of socks, and zipped the bag shut.
"I'm ready."
"Me too,"
Ted said.
Ted was unhappy. He didn't want to leave.
"I guess we can't delay it any longer. The weather's getting worse. They got all the divers out from DH-7, and now there's only us."
Norman smiled at the prospect of being on the surface again. "I never thought I'd look forward to seeing Navy Battleship Gray on a ship, but I do."
"Where are the others?" Norman said.
"Beth's already packed. I think she's with Barnes in communication. Harry, too, I guess."
Ted plucked at his jumpsuit.
"I'll tell you one thing. I'll be glad to see the last of this suit."
They left the sleeping quarters, heading down to communications. On the way, they squeezed past Teeny Fletcher, who was going toward B-cylinder.
"Ready to leave?" Norman said.
"Yes, sir, all squared away,"
Fletcher said, but her features were tense, and she seemed rushed, under pressure.
"Aren't you going the wrong way?" Norman asked.
"Just checking the diesel backups."
Backups? Norman thought. Why check the backups now that they were leaving?
"She probably left something on that she shouldn't have,"
Ted said, shaking his head. In the communications console, the mood was grim. Barnes was on the phone with the surface vessels.
"Say that again," he said. "I want to hear who's authorized that."
He was frowning, angry. They looked at Tina. "How's the weather on the surface?"
"Deteriorating fast, apparently."
Barnes spun. "Will you idiots keep it down?"
Norman dropped his day bag on the floor. Beth was sitting near the portholes, tired, rubbing her eyes. Tina was turning off the monitors one after another when she suddenly stopped.
"Look."
On one monitor, they saw the polished sphere. Harry was standing next to it.
"What's he doing there?"
"Didn't he come back with us?"
"I thought he did."
"I didn't notice. I assumed he did."
"God damn it, I thought I told you people..."
Barnes began and then stopped. He stared at the monitor. On the screen, Harry turned toward the video camera and made a short bow.
"Ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. I think you will find this of interest."
Harry turned to face the sphere. He stood with his arms at his sides, relaxed. He did not move or speak. He closed his eyes. He took a deep breath. The door to the sphere opened.
Not bad, huh? Harry said with a sudden grin. Then Harry stepped inside the sphere. The door closed behind him. They all began talking at once. Barnes was shouting over everyone else, shouting for quiet, but no one paid any attention until the lights in the habitat went out. They were plunged into darkness. Ted said, "What's happened?" The only light came through the portholes, faintly, from the grid lights. A moment later, the grid went out, too.
"No power."
"I tried to tell you," Barnes said. There was a whirring sound, and the lights flickered, then came back on. "We have internal power. We're running on our diesels now."
"Why?"
"Look," Ted said, pointing out the porthole. Outside, they saw what looked like a wriggling silver snake. Then Norman realized it was the cable that linked them to the surface, sliding back and forth across the porthole as it coiled in great loops on the bottom.
"They've cut us free."
"That's right," Barnes said. "They've got full gale force conditions topside. They can no longer maintain cables for power and communications. They can no longer use the submarines. They've taken all the divers up, but the subs can't come back for us. At least not for a few days, until the seas calm down."
"And we're stuck down here?"
"That's correct."
"For how long?"
"Several days," Barnes said.
"For how long?"
"Maybe as long as a week."
"Jesus Christ," Beth said.
Ted tossed his bag onto the couch.
"What a fantastic piece of luck," he said.
Beth spun.
"Are you out of your mind?"
"Let's all stay calm," Barnes said. "Everything's under control. This is just a temporary delay. There's no reason to get upset." But Norman didn't feel upset. He felt suddenly exhausted. Beth was sulking, angry, feeling deceived. Ted was excited, already planning another excursion to the spacecraft, arranging equipment with Edmonds. But Norman felt only tired. His eyes were heavy. He thought he might go to sleep standing there in front of the monitors. He excused himself hurriedly, went back to his bunk, lay down. He didn't care that the sheets were clammy. He didn't care that the pillow was cold. He didn't care that diesels were droning and vibrating in the next cylinder. He thought, this is a very strong avoidance reaction. And then he was asleep. Beyond Pluto. Norman rolled out of bed and looked for his watch, but he'd gotten into the habit of not wearing one down here. He had no idea what time it was, how long he had been asleep. He looked out the porthole, saw nothing but black water. The grid lights were still off. He lay back in his bunk and looked at the gray pipes directly over his head. They seemed closer than before, as if they had moved toward him while he slept. Everything seemed cramped, tighter, more claustrophobic. Several more days of this, he thought. God! He hoped the Navy would think to notify his family. After so many days, Ellen would start to worry. He imagined her first calling the FAA, then calling the Navy, trying to find out what had happened. Of course, no one would know anything because the project was classified. Ellen would be frantic. Then he stopped thinking about Ellen. It was easier, he thought, to worry about your loved ones than to worry about yourself. But there wasn't any point. Ellen would be okay, and so would he. It was just a matter of waiting, staying calm, and waiting out the storm. He got into the shower, wondering if they'd still have hot water while the habitat was on emergency power. They did, and he felt less stiff after his shower. It was odd, he thought, to be 1,000 feet underwater and to relish the soothing effects of a hot shower. He dressed and headed for the sea cylinder. He heard Tina's voice say, "Think they'll ever get the sphere open?" Maybe, I don't know. It scares me. I don't think there's a reason to be scared. It's the unknown, Tina said. When Norman came in, he found Beth running the videotape, looking at herself and Tina. Sure, Beth said on the videotape. But an unknown thing is not likely to be dangerous or frightening. It's most likely to be just inexplicable. Tina said, I don't know how you can say that. You afraid of snakes? Beth said on screen. Beth snapped off the videotape. Just trying to see if I could figure out why it opened, she said. Any luck? Norman said.
Not so far.
On the adjacent monitor, they could see the sphere itself. The sphere was closed.
Harry still in there? Norman said.
Yes, Beth said.
How long has it been now?
She looked up at the consoles.
A little more than an hour.
I only slept an hour?
Yeah.
I'm starving, Norman said, and he went down to the galley to eat. All the coconut cake was gone. He was looking for something else to eat when Beth showed up.
I don't know what to do, Norman, she said, frowning.
About what?
They're lying to us, she said.
Who is?
Barnes, the Navy, everybody. This is all a setup, Norman.
Come on, Beth. No conspiracies now. We have enough to worry about without...
Just look at this, she said. She led him back upstairs, clicked on a console, pressed buttons.
I started putting it together when Barnes was on the phone, she said. Barnes was talking to somebody right up to the moment when the cable started to coil down.
Except that cable is 1,000 feet long, Norman. They would have broken communications several minutes before unhooking the cable itself.
Probably, yes.
So who was Barnes talking to at the last minute?
Nobody.
Beth, look, she said, pointing to the screen.
Comm summary, DH-CIRCOM/1. 0910, Barnes to CIRCOM/1. Civilian and USN personnel polled. Although advised of risks, all personnel elect to remain down for duration of storm to continue investigation of alien sphere and associated spacecraft. Barnes, USN.
You're kidding, Roman said. I thought Barnes wanted to leave.
He did, but he changed his mind when he saw that last room, and he didn't bother to tell us.
I'd like to kill the bastard,
Beth said.
You know what this is about, Norman, don't you?
Norman nodded. He hopes to find a new weapon.
Right, Barnes is a Pentagon acquisition man, and he wants to find a new weapon.
But the sphere is unlikely.
It's not the sphere, Beth said. Barnes doesn't really care about the sphere. He cares about the associated spacecraft.
Because according to congruity theory, it's the spacecraft that is likely to pay off, not the sphere.
Congruity theory was a troublesome matter for the people who thought about extraterrestrial life. In a simple way, the astronomers and physicists who considered the possibility of contact with extraterrestrial life imagined wonderful benefits to mankind from such a contact. But other thinkers, philosophers, and historians did not foresee any benefits to contact at all. For example, astronomers believed that if we made contact with extraterrestrials, mankind would be so shocked that wars on Earth would cease, and a new era of peaceful cooperation between nations would begin. But historians thought that was nonsense. They pointed out that when Europeans discovered the New World, a similarly world-shattering discovery, the Europeans did not stop their incessant fighting. On the contrary, they fought even harder. Europeans simply made the New World an extension of pre-existing animosities. It became another place to fight, and to fight over. Similarly, astronomers imagined that when mankind met extraterrestrials, there would be an exchange of information and technology, giving mankind a wonderful advancement. Historians of science thought that was nonsense, too. They pointed out that what we called science actually consisted of a rather arbitrary conception of the universe, not likely to be shared by other creatures. Our ideas of science were the ideas of visually oriented monkey-like creatures who enjoyed changing their physical environment. If the aliens were blind and communicated by odors, they might have evolved a very different science, which described a very different universe. And they might have made very different choices about the directions their science would explore. For example, they might ignore the physical world entirely, and instead develop a highly sophisticated science of mind. In other words, the exact opposite of what Earth science had done. The alien technology might be purely mental, with no visible hardware at all. This issue was at the heart of congruity theory, which said that unless the aliens were remarkably similar to us, no exchange of information was likely. Barnes, of course, knew that theory. So he knew he wasn't likely to derive any useful technology from the alien sphere. But he was very likely to get useful technology from the spaceship itself.
since the spaceship had been made by men, and congruity was high. And he had lied to keep them down, to keep the search going. "What should we do with the bastard?" Beth said.
"Nothing for the moment," Norman said.
"You don't want to confront him? Jesus, I do."
"It won't serve any purpose," Norman said.
"Ted won't care. And the Navy people are all following orders. And anyway, even if it had been arranged for us to depart as planned, would you have gone, leaving Harry behind in the sphere?"
"No," Beth admitted.
"Well then, it's all academic." "Jesus, Norman!" "I know, but we're here now, and for the next couple of days there's not a damn thing we can do about it. Let's deal with that reality as best we can and point the finger later."
"You bet I'm going to point the finger."
"That's fine, but not now, Beth."
"Okay," she sighed. "Not now."
She went back upstairs. Alone, Norman stared at the console. He had his work cut out for him, keeping everybody calm for the next few days. He hadn't looked into the computer system before. He started pressing buttons. Pretty soon he found the file marked ULF Contact Team, Biog. He opened it up. Civilian team members. 1. Theodore Fielding, astrophysicist, planetary geologist. 2. Elizabeth Halpern, zoologist, biochemist. 3. Harold J. Adams, mathematician, logician. 4. Arthur Levine, marine biologist, biochemist. 5. John F. Thompson, psychologist. Choose one. Norman stared in disbelief at the list. He knew Jack Thompson, an energetic young psychologist from Yale. Thompson was world-renowned for his studies of the psychology of primitive peoples, and in fact for the past year had been somewhere in New Guinea studying native tribes. Norman pressed more buttons. ULF team psychologist choices by rank. 1. John F. Thompson, Yale, approved. 2. William L. Hartz, UCB, approved. 3. Jeremy White, UT, approved, pending clearance. 4. Norman Johnson, SDU, rejected, age. He knew them all. Bill Hartz at Berkeley was seriously ill with cancer. Jeremy White had gone to Hanoi during the Vietnam War and would never get clearance. That left Norman. He understood now why he had been the last to be called in. He understood now about the special tests. He felt a burst of intense anger at Barnes, at the whole system which had brought him down here, despite his age, with no concern for his safety. At 53, Norman Johnson had no business being 1,000 feet underwater in a pressurized exotic gas environment, and the Navy knew it. It was an outrage, he thought. He wanted to go upstairs and give Barnes hell in no uncertain terms, that lying son of a bitch. He gripped the arms of his chair and reminded himself of what he had told Beth. Whatever had happened up to this point, there was nothing any of them could do about it now. He would indeed give Barnes hell. He promised himself he would, but only when they got back to the surface. Until then, it was no use making trouble. He shook his head and swore. Then he turned the console off. The hours crept by. Harry was still in the sphere. Tina ran her image intensification of the videotape that showed the sphere open, trying to see interior detail. "Unfortunately, we have only limited computing power in the habitat," she said. "If I could hardlink to the surface, I could really do a job, but as it is..." She shrugged. She showed them a series of enlarged freeze frames from the open sphere. The images clicked through at 1-second intervals. The quality was poor, with jagged, intermittent static. "The only internal structures we can see in the blackness," Tina said, pointing to the opening, "are these multiple point sources of light. The lights appear to move from frame to frame."
"It's as if the sphere is filled with fireflies," Beth said.
"Except these lights are much dimmer than fireflies, and they don't blink. They are very numerous, and they give the impression of moving together in surging patterns."
"A flock of fireflies?"
"Something like that."
The tape ran out. The screen went dark. Ted said,
"That's it?"
"I'm afraid so, Dr. Fielding."
Poor Harry, Ted said mournfully.
Of all the group, Ted was the most visibly upset about Harry. He kept staring at the closed sphere on the monitor, saying, "How did he do that?" Then he would add, "I hope he's all right." He repeated it so often that finally Beth said, "I think we know your feelings, Ted."
"I'm seriously concerned about him."
"I am, too. We all are."
"You think I'm jealous, Beth? Is that what you're saying?"
"Why would anyone think that, Ted?" Norman changed the subject. It was crucial to avoid confrontations among group members. He asked Ted about his analysis of the flight data aboard the spaceship.
"It's very interesting," Ted said, warming to his subject. "My detailed examination of the earliest flight data images," he said, "convinced me that they show three planets, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and the Sun very small in the background. Therefore, the pictures are taken from some point beyond the orbit of Pluto. This suggests that the black hole is not far beyond our own solar system."
"Is that possible?" Norman said.
"Oh, sure. In fact, for the last 10 years, some astrophysicists have suspected that there's a black hole, not a large one, but a black hole, just outside our solar system."
"I hadn't heard that."
"Oh, yes. In fact, some of us have argued that if it was small enough, in a few years we could go out and capture the black hole, bring it back, park it in Earth orbit, and use the energy it generates to power the entire planet."
Barnes smiled. "Black hole cowboys?"
"In theory, there's no reason it couldn't be done.
Then just think. The entire planet would be free of its dependency on fossil fuels. The whole history of mankind would be changed."
Barnes said,
"Probably make a hell of a weapon, too."
"Even a very tiny black hole would be a little too powerful to use as a weapon."
"So you think this ship went out to capture a black hole?"
"I doubt it," Ted said. "The ship is so strongly made, so shielded against radiation, that I suspect it was intended to go through a black hole, and it did."
"And that's why the ship went back in time?" Norman said.
"I'm not sure," Ted said. "You see, a black hole really is the edge of the universe. What happens there isn't clear to anybody now alive. But what some people think is that you don't go through the hole, you sort of skip into it like a pebble skipping over water, and you get bounced into a different time or space or universe."
"So the ship got bounced?"
"Yes, possibly more than once. And when it bounced back here, it undershot and arrived a few hundred years before it left."
"And on one of its bounces it picked up that?" Beth said, pointing to the monitor. They looked. The sphere was still closed, but lying next to it, sprawled on the deck in an awkward pose, was Harry Adams. For a moment they thought he was dead. Then Harry lifted his head and moaned. "The subject." Norman wrote in his notebook, "Subject is a 30-year-old black mathematician who has spent 3 hours inside a sphere of unknown origin. On recovery from the sphere, was stuporous and unresponsive. He did not know his name, where he was, or what year it was. Brought back to habitat, slept for 1.5 hour, then awoke abruptly, complaining of headache."
"Oh, God."
Harry was sitting in his bunk, holding his head in his hands, groaning.
"Hurt?" Norman asked.
"Brutal."
"Pounding."
"Anything else?"
"Thirsty."
"God."
He licked his lips.
"Really thirsty."
"Extreme thirst," Norman wrote.
Rose Levy, the cook, showed up with a glass of lemonade. Norman handed the glass to Harry, who drank it in a single gulp, passed it back.
"More."
"Better bring a pitcher," Norman said. Levy went off. Norman turned to Harry, still holding his head, still groaning, and said, "I have a question for you."
"What?"
"What's your name?"
"Norman, I don't need to be psychoanalyzed right now.
Just tell me your name."
"Harry Adams, for Christ's sake. What's the matter with you?"
"Oh, my head."
"You didn't remember before," Norman said,
"when we found you."
"When you found me?" he asked. He seemed confused again. Norman nodded.
"Do you remember when we found you?"
"It must have been outside."
"Outside?" Harry looked up, suddenly furious, eyes glowing with rage.
Outside the sphere, you goddamn idiot! What do you think I'm talking about?
Take it easy, Harry. Your questions are driving me crazy.
Okay, okay, take it easy.
Emotionally labile, rage and irritability. Norman made more notes.
Do you have to make so much noise?
Norman looked up, puzzled.
Your pan, Harry said.
It sounds like Niagara Falls.
Norman stopped writing. It must be a migraine or something like migraine. Harry was holding his head in his hands delicately, as if it were made of glass.
Why can't I have any aspirin, for Christ's sake?
We don't want to give you anything for a while in case you hurt yourself. We need to know where the pain is.
The pain, Norman, is in my head. It's in my goddamn head. Now, why won't you give me any aspirin?
Barnes said not to.
Is Barnes still here?
We're all still here. Harry looked up slowly. But you were supposed to go to the surface.
I know. Why didn't you go?
The weather went bad and they couldn't send the subs.
Well, you should go. You shouldn't be here, Norman.
Levy arrived with more lemonade. Harry looked at her as he drank.
You're still here, too?
Yes, Dr. Adams.
How many people are down here altogether?
Levy said, there are 9 of us, sir.
Jesus.
He passed the glass back. Levy refilled it.
You should all go. You should leave.
Harry, Norman said,
we can't go.
You have to go.
Norman sat on the bunk opposite Harry and watched as Harry drank. Harry was demonstrating a rather typical manifestation of shock, the agitation, the irritability, the nervous, manic flow of ideas, the unexplained fears for the safety of others. It was all characteristic of shocked victims of severe accidents, such as major auto crashes or airplane crashes. Given an intense event, the brain struggled to assimilate, to make sense, to reassemble the mental world even as the physical world was shattered around it. The brain went into a kind of overdrive, hastily trying to reassemble things, to get things right, to reestablish equilibrium. Yet it was fundamentally a confused period of wheel spinning. You just had to wait it out. Harry finished the lemonade and handed the glass back.
More? Levy asked.
No, that's good. Headaches, better.
Perhaps it was dehydration after all, Norman thought.
But why would Harry be dehydrated after 3 hours in the sphere?
Harry,
tell me something. Do I look different, Norman?
No.
I look the same to you?
Yes, I'd say so.
Are you sure?
Harry said. He jumped up, went to a mirror mounted on the wall. He peered at his face. How do you think you look? Norman said.
I don't know. Different.
Different how?
I don't know.
He pounded the padded wall next to the mirror. The mirror image vibrated. He turned away, sat down on the bunk again. He sighed.
Just different.
Harry.
What?
Do you remember what happened?
Of course.
What happened?
I went inside.
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.